next speaker is Nigel Evans. Nigel has had a lifelong interest in astronomy, but for a number of years he thought that people who traveled halfway around the world for a several minute event were, let me see, quote, barking mad. But apparently he's changed his mind, and he's going to talk to us today about flash.
Yes, if I could have the lights down, please. So, yes, following on from Mark's talk, yes, you can't do everything, but there's nothing wrong with trying. I do like to try and record it in as many ways as possible. For example, I've tried the ultra-wide fisheye lens. This is from Curacao, and in that you see the lovely blue sky and the twilight effects all the way around the horizon. And in this case, we were lucky to catch three planets also in the field of view. We could step a little closer, and we go to, say, looking at the corona. And in this case, it's quite a long exposure, and we're fortunate enough we can catch a star in the background field. Now, probably many pictures before, they've been dismissed as bits of dust and so on, but that is actually there. We're somewhat away from confirming Einstein's predictions of anything there, but otherwise, we can even go, perhaps you're more interested in the Bayless beads at the beginning and end of the eclipse. This is from India, which was fairly short, about 45 seconds. Or maybe you just go straight to the chromosphere and the prominences. Or, if you're feeling very adventurous, you can go to the multiple exposure picture, trying to map out the partial phases along with the total phase in the middle. And this is a genuine in-camera multiple exposure, not a Photoshop composite. So, what else can we do? Well, one of the things I've never tried is shadow bands, and the thing about those is the sun isn't in those. So, but one of the other things I've had a go at is the flash spectrum. So, what is it? Well, essentially, it's an emission spectrum from the chromosphere, and as the sun obscures the photosphere, there are many hundreds of dark lines in the photosphere, but as the moon obscures the last part of the photosphere, a few of those lines actually go from being absorption into emission, and hence the name flash spectrum. And that was first observed by Charles Young in 1870. So, when can you see it? It's second contact and third contact. Immediately after second contact, immediately before third contact. So, what do you really need extra to record it? Well, what you really need is a dispersive element. Could be a prism, but generally it's going to be a diffraction grating. So, this is an example of using a diffraction grating on an object with a continuous spectrum. It's the sun. And I've chosen, as a personal choice only, that I want to get the zero order image and the first order image in the same field of view. So that does limit how strong the dispersion can be, or the combination of the dispersion and the focal length of the lens I'm going to use. So in this case, it's a okay sort of focal length, but the dispersion has to be quite low in order to fit the spectrum in a 35mm frame. So if I went to, say, a longer focal length, what I'm effectively doing is magnifying the picture, and I wouldn't be able to do what I'm doing here, and I'd just end up with, say, you know, if I doubled the focal length, I'd just end up with this bit magnified twice as big in all dimensions. If I used a stronger grating on with this focal length, this part would all shift out further down here. It would be spread out further. But with a continuous an object with a continuous spectrum, I just get this coloured mess. Wouldn't really tell me anything. Now, it's not often that an astronomer or an amateur astronomer would introduce a street light into a talk. But this is the street light outside my house, And the only reason it's here is because it doesn't have a continuous spectrum. And so when you look at it through a camera via a diffraction grating at that street light, you get a dispersion of the colours, and what you end up with is individual images at specific wavelengths. You end up with, if you like, an image of the lamp at the individual discrete wavelengths it emits. We are effectively have, we've got a slitless spectrograph. And so we can see quite clearly that, you know, here is the sort of image of the street light. Now, with the gratings I've got here, this one is glazed, which means it puts all the lights into one primary order, the first order. So this is where most of the light goes. But you can actually use the second order. It's somewhat weaker, so longer exposures are required to record this image. But what you end up with is a wider spectrum, but at each point, the image of the of your object is the same. It's not just getting back and stretching the picture by a factor of two. The colour would stretch by a factor of two, but the individual images in there are still images of the original object. So what does it look like? Well, I don't have a research grant, so I have to build some of these things myself. Now, if this was a piece of art, this might be described as primitive or ethnic. as I currently live in East Anglia, which is the bit of England to the east of here, so it'd be native art. But I just regard this as practical. What it does, it enables me to reflect and diffract the image of the sun into my camera. I can rotate it, I can tilt it, and your it as well. So yes, it's practical. So right, we're now on site. This is in Turkey in 99, and this is my gadget in at work. Well, actually, it's finished working. Most of the cameras are pointing up towards the sun. My one's actually pointing, that one there is pointing backwards because it's looking into the grating pretty well full on, but not so full on that it obscures itself. Because I have one, two, three, four, plus the fifth one that's actually taking this picture, cameras, I can't operate all those on my own, so I have developed a system of trying to computer control it. It's essentially Glenn Snyder's system, but put into a Scion 3C, which was, it was the top thing when I bought it, but it's now obsolete, but it still works, unlike Chris O'Brien's Scion 5. What it does, it controls the relay box, which then controls eight relays, or so that potentially control eight cameras, I suppose, and it just does all the photography for me, which means I get the time to watch the eclipse. Well, that's the theory anyway. But as with many of these things, things drop off and don't go right, and so on. So that's the camera for the flash spectrum, and how do we come out? Well, that's how I managed to do. Now, what we have in that picture, these are just the two stop intervals between each of these pictures. Most of the lines in the spectrum are like ones you would find in the normal continuum of the sun, the hydrogen ones and the calcium ones. But what you can pick out are two things that you don't have on the sun. The first one is the yellow one. Obviously, we now know it's due to neutral helium, but when it was observed in 1868, initially it was thought to be sodium because it is very close to the sodium D line. But at the eclipse of 1868, both Lockyer and Janssen proposed that this was actually an element, a new element. It wasn't until 1895 that it was isolated on Earth. I think we're all familiar with the story of why it's called helium, because it's named after Helios, the Greek for the sun. So, and the reason why you can see neutral helium here glowing, whereas you can't see helium easily in the spectrum of the sun, is that helium needs to be at about 10,000 degrees in order to glow, and with the surface of the sun only being 5 or 6, there's not enough to show the feature. So that gave us the indication that the chromosphere, the upper parts of the chromosphere at least, are hotter than the sun because the neutral helium is actually glowing. The second feature, if I can
point it out noisily, is this other one here, which initially was assigned by Young in 1869 to be yet another element. And because it was only visible in the corona, it became known as coronium, and it was another 70 years before it was eventually determined that it's not some new fancy element, but it's actually 13 times ionized iron at a temperature of 2 million degrees. So that was the sequence of different exposures. Now, we have a series through time here. Each one of these is the same exposure, but 3 seconds apart. And in those 3 seconds, the moon moves about 3 kilometres, but projected on the sun, that's 1,200 kilometres. So as the moon moves away, it is showing a level 1,200 kilometres lower down than the previous picture. Now, this one, we've actually gone slightly too far, in that the normal photosphere has now come back in and it's just bleached the picture there. But we are, as time marches on, we can start to see more and more detailed lines coming in from the lower levels of the chromosphere. So what other wacky things can we do? Well, this is actually after the end of the eclipse, and I had a frame left. So in goes the solar filter, and we have a thin slit source still, or reasonably thin, and we end up with this rather bizarre looking thing recorded here. And what we really have there is confirmation that I was looking through a piece of Bader film, and I'm just getting the interference features that Ralph Chu showed earlier this afternoon. Also, the colour film, I only seem to have 3 colours, red, green and blue. Don't know what happened to yellow and orange and all those others, but yes, and as I don't have a research student, I can't get them to work out the effective refractive index of the polymer or anything horrid like that. So, where can we go from here? Well, as I wanted to completely automate the recording of the eclipse, and we then went on to Zimbabwe in 2001, the sun moves quite a bit during the 3 minutes 20 seconds or so that we're going to be there. So what I wanted to do was get the flash spectrum at both second and third contact, but need something to follow the sun. So what we have here is an alarm clock, an ordinary alarm clock, and then we have a 4-to-1 ratio pulley system here, so effectively drives the grating round once every 48 hours. Now, I'm not suggesting it's going to last 48 hours, but what it's doing is generally derotating the sky. And it doesn't have to be, it's set for, you know, it's pointing downwards because I was going to Zimbabwe, but what it's doing is just generally taking the motion out of the sky. It doesn't have to be perfect alignment. If it took 90% of the rotation out, that's good enough. I just need to keep the frame or the image of the sun and its first order spectrum reasonably in the field of view for 5 or 10 minutes, because I've set it up just before totality came or finished the alignment, and just let it run and use the whole system to record everything. In the event I was behind schedule, and this is a bit delicate and fiddly to set up, so it never got out of the box, really. Shame, really. We put a lot of effort into building that thing to make it, it's all flip light and so on, because I've got to transport it within my 20 kilos. So, jumping on to the next one, we're now in Australia, and quite a few of us I know were at Woomera, and there were others that were also inland Australia. And on that day, in December 2002, it must have been the windiest day I'd ever seen in Australia, and indeed on any eclipse site. it was so windy that the diffraction grating and the little tripod it was sitting on were being blown over. So I had to get a rock to stop the tripod going over. But with the setup I've got here, where the camera is looking vertically downwards into the grating, the camera is unprotected, and the wind just wobbled that all over the place. So I wasn't particularly hopeful of recording anything with this setup. But with that eclipse of being only 26 seconds long, I set up all the cameras, I used the same control systems I did before, and I just let it go, and it is actually the first eclipse where I have seen it from beginning to end. Because if anything went wrong with that kit, there isn't any time to do anything about it. It fell over, it fell over. And the main thing was that I should have seen it rather than doing all this other stuff. So when it came to how did it come out, well, they're the best I've got. All the longer exposure ones were just trashed by the vibration, the wind, on the camera and the mainly the camera, I think. But these are quite hard scanned in order to bring out what little image there is. But I suppose, given the circumstances, I'm quite pleased with them. Yet again, I've got this sort of, I have a red image, I have a green image, I have a blue image. The helium seems to have, is no longer yellow. But it's an artifact of the film and the weak image of the film and scanning it. The other thing I didn't realise at the time was the images aren't particularly round. And initially I thought, oh, that's atmospheric refraction. But the sun is 6 degrees high. And given I've got the zero image here that's not distorted, it's nothing to do with how high it is. And it wasn't until afterwards I realised what had happened. And it's because I don't have a round, a light that's round that emits a discrete spectrum that I could actually test this out. This has been my test subject. The chromosphere of the sun, and what it's due to is the way that the diffraction gratings run, that I've got a fairly modest dispersion in the diffraction grating, so my incident and exit angles are or the sign difference of the sign between them is only a fairly small value. But what you have is that for a change in theta, you get you don't get an equal change in your input angle. You don't get an equal change in your output angle. And so, because I was running at about 40 an instant angle of about 45 degrees, and the camera's looking down, sun's over there somewhere, I'm running about here. So my images aren't round; they have a sort of 90% aspect ratio. Whereas in the 99 eclipse, I was running at about 20 degrees, and you couldn't really tell in those images. It was only became aware of what was happening when you have an oblique grating. So that's the end of the flash. Obviously, I didn't go to Antarctica in the plane, the boat, or whatever. But after the Australian eclipse, after it finished, there's sitting around waiting for the sunset, and I think now we can get the effect of the sun is not round here. But where we were in Woomera, the skyline is absolutely flat. It is the flattest place I've ever seen, and so quite a few of us took the opportunity to record sunset of a partial eclipse, and we've just never been in this position before. Usually the sun's sort of up there somewhere. We took this opportunity, and as the sun got lower, just as the sun broke, was about to break into two halves, so you have two horns to the sun, it went a bit green there. I can't really see it right here. And that was just, it was like, literally, I was using up the six frames at the end of the roll. It was, yeah, I'll do this, get, and got that. then as it sets, I end up with this two horn effect, and it's still going a bit green at the end here. I must admit I was looking through the telescope too much at this time. If Ralph had seen me, he'd have shot me anyway. So it was just, right, I'll just take a few pictures, and then just as the lower horn set, I got it just at the right moment that it went green. So if you don't mind, I was pretty chuffed over that. And then, you know, we ended up with the single horn and so on. So to round off, well, taking the the flat spectrum is reasonably straightforward to do, and you need the usual things. You've got to be in the eclipse track, you've got to have clear weather and all that sort of stuff. But the next opportunities will be next year and the year before. And the fact that next year is on a ship won't actually preclude anyone trying it. I won't be there, but I will be there. I will be there. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Nigel. You still have 9 minutes. Jay.
Well, I think those are wonderful, both the flat spectrum and the green flash, and I hope I'll get some copies from you.
Yeah.
On the subject first of the flat spectrum, there are actually two chromospheric lines and two coronal lines that I'll be glad to look at you to see just what you have. But in each, there's a red line and a green or yellow line. Mm-hmm. So just what the difference in the red is, because you had a big red image there, it looked much too high and too big to be H-alpha, to be from the chromosphere. So that may have been the red coronal line.
Right.
There. And then you showed the helium line, which showed the prominences. But the green line of the corona was hard to determine, and that would be the complete ring.
Yeah.
So let's work on identifying that. Yeah. I'm sorry that you didn't pull out your flash spectrum for the green flash at the end. And my question is then, what was your budget, and in particular, how much did the grating cost?
The grating was, I think, about £150. I just had to buy it as a commercial, scientific grating.
And what was the size of it?
It's a 2-inch square.
Even the 2001?
Yeah.
A little bigger.
Oh, yes. It's the effect of photographing it close. It's not something I use any other time other than take the eclipses of the sun. So it's one of the things that literally covers the time.
Yes, Daniel.
Just a suggestion for people who plan to shoot their first flash spectrum. I saw my very first second contact through a diffraction grating. So before I even saw the real eclipse, I took my first and only flash spectrum series. And I found out it makes sense to continue shooting away until the chromosphere is gone completely, because then only the green coronium line stays there. And you have this continuum spectrum again, but you have this nice green ring there. So it's very didactical to show this sequence to people. To see all the chromosphere lines appear and then disappear, and only the corona line remains.
Yeah, so with the corona, if you could use a higher dispersion, you'd spread out the continuum color, make that fainter effectively, and have the ring standing out more prominently. Because I chose to say I want the sun and its first order, there is a natural high background level that doesn't have that corona line. Quite hard to see, really. But with a higher dispersion grating, I just concentrate on part of the spectrum, then that becomes much more common. But yeah, looking through, that's one thing I did do in the 90s, was checking the gear, was actually look through the camera, as the flash spectrum, and see all these sort of ring images. Mm-hmm. The prominences, and that was quite surreal.
Yeah, they're beautiful, yeah. Mm-hmm.